First time I've ever known an audience fall silent, absolutely on time. So I think that's a good signal for us to begin this evening. Welcome to the Humanities Research Institute. I'm David Shepherd. I'm Director of Research for Arts and Humanities and Director of the Humanities Research Institute. And it's my very great pleasure to welcome you all to this latest of the series of inaugural lectures that the HRI hosts. These lectures are intended to offer opportunities for recently appointed professors in the Arts and Humanities Division to spell out their vision for the development of their subject and thereby bring the excellence of humanities research at Sheffield to the attention of a broad audience, both within and indeed beyond the university. And it's in pursuit of that latter aim that, in the usual way, we will make an MP3 recording of this evening's lecture available on the HRI's website as soon as possible. And that is possible for us, thanks very much to the input and assistance of Ray Davis of the University's Audiovisual Services. And I'd like to thank him very much for putting the effort in that he has to ensure that this evening will go very smoothly. And I'd also like at this stage, if I may, to thank Julie Bannon, HRI Secretary, who's been checking you in at the door for all the organisational work that she's done in advance of this evening's lecture. In the usual way, at the end of this evening's lecture, we won't be subjecting the lecturer to formal interrogation. That's not the way we do things. But there will be a chance for informal conversation over a glass of wine or a soft drink, if you prefer, immediately after the lecture. And the drinks will be served just through the double doors there or through the door which is behind people here. So let me move, if I may, to introducing this evening's lecturer. Our lecturer is Professor Sue Weiss of the School of English Literature, Language and Linguistics. And at this stage I'd like to extend an especially warm welcome to Sue's parents, Elizabeth and Tony Weiss. Is as nothing compared to her versatility as a scholar. Her first degree at Cambridge was followed by a DPhil at Oxford on Malcolm Lowry in 1988. This led to the publication the following year of her first book, Malcolm Lowry, 80 Years On. It was in that same year that she came to the University of Sheffield, having spent a year working with Basil Blackwell. Since that time, she has progressed through the academic ranks, receiving a personal chair in 2004, and it is that chair that we are formally inaugurating this evening. If I can permit myself a personal note here, when I myself came to Sheffield in 1994, Sue Weiss's was a name with which I was already very familiar. She and I share an interest in the work of the Russian cultural theorist, some including the man himself would have said philosopher, Mikhail Bakhtin, whose work exerted a notable influence on Sue's study of Lowry. It was therefore no surprise that she published Introducing Bakhtin in 1997 with Manchester University Press. And I must say that one of the highlights of my time at Sheffield has been co-supervising with Sue the doctoral work of a research student attached to the Bakhtin Centre, of which I also happen to be director. But that student wasn't working on anything to do with Bakhtin, but on the subject of electronic hyperfiction. That's another indication, I think, of the range of Sue's expertise and interests, and I can assure you that it was not only our supervisee who was kept on his toes and tested to the limit. As well as working on Bakhtin in the 1990s, Sue produced Psychoanalytic Criticism, A Reader, in 1996, 2 years after she'd collaborated with Tim Armstrong and Matt Campbell on a volume devoted to addiction, Beyond the Pleasure Dome, Writing and Addiction from the Romantics. Now, I'm sure Sue, and indeed her family, must be used to and heartily tired of predictable puns on her surname. But it's difficult not to suspect that her greatest vice is indeed an addiction to learning every bit as powerful as Lowry's alcoholic ex-consul's addiction to mezcal in Under the Volcano. For while working on all these projects, Sue somehow found time to take an MA in film studies down the road at Sheffield Hallam University. And the abiding interest in film that this further study formalised has been a stimulus not only to her research, but also to her teaching. She has, for example, taught a course devoted to the films of Alfred Hitchcock, the director of the movie that I gather she would wish to take with her to a desert island, that film being Marnie. But although Sue has now spent a month or two as head of the School of English, which is, after all, long enough to make it forgivable for anyone to yearn for the isolation of the desert island, as a release from the unrelenting and unpredictable pressures of what we like to call academic leadership. It's hard to imagine anyone less suited to such isolation than Sue Vice, unless the definition of desert island can be stretched to include Australia, where I gather she visits family as often as possible. Not for her such privations and hardships as might necessitate harming animals, for example. Although I'm no great dog lover myself, I'm sorry that none of our joint supervisory sessions with our student Colin Gardner was graced by the presence of your beloved dog, Flora. I'm also intrigued to learn that Sue and one of her research students recently organised a conference on the representation of animals, yet another string to the bow. But more seriously, I'm sure that Sue won't allow administrative drudgery to get in the way of exploration of shared human experience in all its forms, among them the most unimaginably terrible. As I'm sure most people here will know, in the current decade, Sue Vice has written two books on Holocaust literature and edited another on the broader representation of the Holocaust. The inauguration yesterday, in this same room, of a new Centre for the Study of Genocide and Mass Violence is testament to the importance of the work done by Sue and other Sheffield scholars in confronting issues that many might find it easier or preferable to pass over in silence. After literature and cinema, drama, a particular strength, of course, of Sheffield School of English. Sue's attention has most recently been focused on the work of the playwright Jack Rosenthal, who held the post of Maisie Glass Professor Associate in Theatre at this university from 1997 to 1998, and whose papers are held, following his death in 2004, in the special collections of the University Library. Sue tells me that she'll submit the typescript of her book about Rosenthal to Manchester University Press at the end of this month. How characteristically impressive that she should have found time in the face of this pressing deadline, with everything else she has to do, to deliver this evening's lecture. And on a topic that is, I have to say, especially appealing to someone who numbers among his own vices a deep attachment, not to say addiction, to soap opera and TV drama. It's with great pleasure and anticipation, therefore, that I now invite Professor Sue Vice to address us on Jack Rosenthal from Coronation Street to Bar Mitzvah Boy. Sue.
Thank you, David, very much. I feel as if I've been on Desert Island Discs without the music. I'm not going to roam around because apparently that's better for everyone concerned, including me, so I'm going to be standing here. Just to reassure you, I am going to be showing some extracts from some of Rosenthal's plays and soap operas, which David has mentioned, and only one of those extracts will we have to search for, so that's a relief to everyone. And I'd just like to also add that I'm speaking primarily as an aunt this evening. I'm very pleased to be here to talk about the television playwright Jack Rosenthal. We're in a building at which the front of which is Georgian, so it must have been here in his time, not that he's quite that old. Rosenthal was a student of English at the university and graduated with a degree in English language and literature in 1953. And in a minute, we'll see an extract from a television documentary in which Rosenthal returned to Sheffield amid buildings which certainly didn't exist in his day. It was Rosenthal's fondness for his alma mater, as David's also mentioned, that led him to deposit his archive here in Special Collections in the main, or as it's now called, Western Bank Library, which I've been using. The archive includes material ranging from scripts of his 250 television and feature films and his stage plays to his undergraduate dissertation on James Joyce, which, as you'll see, especially when we watch Coronation Street, was extremely influential on him, and also a host of fascinating letters from viewers, most of which are complimentary, though not all of them. While the playwright Michael Frayn praises Rosenthal's play The Evacuees for making it seem as if the things in your play had come out of some buried part of my own memory, so accurately does it represent the past and the war, many members of the public wrote in protest at what they call the disgusting portrayal of Jewish life in Bar Mitzvah Boy, and we'll be seeing an extract of that so you can judge for yourselves in a moment. I remember seeing Bar Mitzvah Boy in 1976 when it was shown on television, and I wish that I'd written to Rosenthal, and then I could have found my own letter in the archive. Rosenthal was born in 1931 in Cheetham Hill, Manchester. He died in 2004, leaving a distraught widow in the form of the actor Maureen Lipman, who we'll also see on screen in a moment, and her papers are also in special collections. As many commentators have observed, Rosenthal's background provided a threefold identity and series of themes which are consistent in all his work. Rosenthal was Northern, working class, and Jewish. Of the three, the actor Jonathan Lynn argues that Rosenthal's class background was the most important. Now, to move on to the very first extract, which is from the 1997 documentary called Jack the Lad, we'll see Rosenthal's return to Sheffield to be reunited with some fellow students, and extracts from two of his television plays, the first of which, Eskimo Day, is about children going to university, and it focuses on Rosenthal's trademark interest in class-based and regional language.
He'll be in there now, will Neil? I don't know whither he gets his brains from. Whence from, rather.
Not my side. His auntie Gwen's a JP in Haslingdon. She's a great believer in books.
What?
Bucks.
Bucks. Oh, books.
That's what I said. And Arneel's the same. He's always got his nose in a reading matter.
Pepper likewise. First class brain.
God. Diabolical all this, isn't it?
Tense time for all of us.
I went to Sheffield University to read English. On my first day, we had a lecture on drama, and I learned something I think I'd probably always known.
Protagonist versus antagonist. A football match. The protagonist trying to score a goal, the antagonist trying to stop them. That's drama.
What we're now about to witness is called a football match. Not the beginning of World War III, not the destruction of the human race. A football match. In it, each of the teams will attempt to score more goals than the other.
What are you looking at?
Not much.
That will be done by kicking the ball in the net as opposed to kicking other people in the crutch.
Right. Great. Thank you.
Arguing with the referee will naturally not be tolerated.
Well, who the bloody hell's arguing?
Are you trying to get yourself in the Guinness Book of Records? The only player to be sent off before the game's even started.
Like a bloody tape recorder.
Did you speak?
No, I was yawning.
Heads or tails?
Tails.
Heads it is.
As we are.
May the best team win.
Why?
We had to impose our own discipline, I recall.
Oh, you did.
Well, I remember I had this slogan, library conditions from now. And that meant that people weren't supposed to talk. Right. But then we always dissolved into giggles.
We kind of used to routinely, I mean, always go to the university, always go to the library between lectures, just have specific breaks.
If you work hard, you'll get rewarded. That was the great key. And Jack, I think his anxiety was because he really believed that very strongly, as we all did, but he was slightly more highly strung than most of us.
I think I was relieved when we both finished up with a 2-1. I think Jack was nearly on line for first, really.
I'm in love with my...
This was a so-called song written in our digs during one of Ron's failed attempts at library conditions. Phil said he wrote it. Ron said he did. Matt said he did. Huey said he did. I'm delighted to say, I didn't.
My thoughts are so sweet and mellow as my ideal comes into sight. I close my eyes and there she is. I close my eyes and oh, what bliss. I'm in love with an ideal and my ideal's in love with me.
I can't see that yet. that's what happens to our former students. I'd also just like to say that the room that we saw Rosenthal and his former student colleagues speaking in is now Rachel Falconer's office. Before it was redone. After university at Sheffield, Rosenthal spent his national service being trained as a Russian translator in order to intercept radio messages. And this is the subject of one of his plays called Bye Bye Baby, after the Marilyn Monroe song. On his return to Manchester in 1955, Rosenthal was offered two jobs, one with a men's shirt supplier and the other as a promotion script writer with the fledgling Granada Television Company. He took the job with Granada because it offered £9 a week, a pound more than the shirts. The rest, as they say, is history. In December 1960, the first episode of Granada's new serial Coronation Street was broadcast, with a script by another young Mancunian, Tony Warren. When Rosenthal rang to congratulate Warren, he was offered the chance to contribute an episode himself. Rosenthal describes this in his autobiography, which is called By Jack Rosenthal, as the biggest, luckiest break a hopeful writer could have dreamt of. Episode 30 of Coronation Street by Jack Rosenthal was duly broadcast on the 17th of March 1961. It was not an unqualified success. When it was timed during rehearsal at 25 minutes, which is what all the episodes were, the actor Jack Howarth, who played the curmudgeonly Albert Tatlock, said it was too long by 24 and a half minutes. However, the next brief extract is a notable moment from Rosenthal's first Coronation Street episode.
Aye, there's no doubt about it. Trouble broadens the mind. It opens your eyes to the wonders of the Lord and his bounty.
Aye, but they live different to us abroad, don't they? I mean, it's not like what we have to put up with, is it?
Oh, it's beautiful. The pubs don't close either. Not like here, shouting time as soon as you get a glass in your hand.
Mind you, there's a lot of foreigners there, isn't there?
Where?
Abroad. I mean, they don't talk like us for a start, do they? Not proper.
What I was saying is it's an education to see what goes on in the world.
You know, you want to keep your ears open when Ina's talking. You might learn something.
I went to London on one of Clough's coaches for Festival of Britain.
Ah, well, you would, wouldn't you?
I got the 5-shilling piece. I've still got it behind clock in scullery.
Have you? You're a proper little Dr. Livingstone when you get going, aren't you? You're slopping your stout.
I think you can see lots of themes from Rosenthal's future work there. For example, parochialism, an interest in utterance, accents, dialect, and also specific details of class-related life. And, like many episodes of Coronation Street, the one that we've just seen offers an implicit challenge to the viewer. Elsewhere, the three women are shown raptly watching a washing machine whirling round and explicitly saying it's just as good as watching the television. Rosenthal somewhat ruined the positive effect of this scene by admitting that the best line in Ina Sharple's dialogue, which we didn't hear, where she says, "One walk down the canal and they think they're charting the Ganges," actually came from his colleague Geoffrey Lancashire. It's true that Rosenthal's first episode is full of much plot-free dialogue and doesn't resemble the much more interesting episodes that he wrote later in the series when he got into his stride. For instance, in 1964, Rosenthal wrote an episode which is a pastiche of Fred Zinnemann's 1952 film High Noon, a pastiche which is declared by the shot construction and the soundtrack. In this episode, Len Fairclough takes Gary Cooper's role and confronts three thugs all on his own. This is a mock heroic joke, which also acknowledges the fact that, like higher art forms such as Westerns, arguably, soap operas are in the business of what a critic has called constructing moral consensus about the conduct of personal life. It's clear that writing for Coronation Street between 1961 and 1969 was a profoundly formative experience for Rosenthal. He learned a great deal from Tony Warren and from the other writers of the time, who included Vince Powell and Harry Driver, Peter Eckersley, who went on to be the head of Granada Drama, and Adele Rose. Indeed, what we think of as characteristic of Rosenthal's later style came from this source. Not only did Coronation Street introduce into mainstream television the kinds of working class representation that Rosenthal continued, for instance, in his late 1960s sitcom The Dustbin Men and his plays The Knowledge about trainee taxi drivers and The Chain about furniture removal men. Also, Rosenthal's trademark linguistic humour and dialogue have their source here. This dialogue, which I would describe as everyday surrealism, and you probably get an idea of that from the Coronation Street episode, is characterised by non-sequiturs, people failing to understand or to reply to each other, and a mixture of classical with down-to-earth discourse, which I like to think is reminiscent of Samuel Beckett's plays. As if they were characters from the ashcans of Beckett's Endgame, Rosenthal's Dustbin Men quote Keats and lament their physical frailties. In a habit developed in Coronation Street, whole stretches of dialogue in Rosenthal's plays can consist of the word pardon or its synonyms. We can see this in the next extract, which is very brief, so don't blink. This is from Rosenthal's sitcom called The Lovers from 1970, in which Jeffrey, the young man, is reluctant to meet his girlfriend Beryl's married friends as he fears she's brainwashing him.
Oh, and this is Jeffrey, is it?
Is what?
Yes, he is. Aren't you, Jeffrey?
What?
He has the same sense of humour as Neville.
I really showed that so you could see Maureen Lipman as a teenager, not to mention Richard Beckinsale. The film critic of the Financial Times, Chris Dunkley, has compared Rosenthal to Jane Austen, in the sense that both are miniaturists working on, as Austen put it, a tiny piece of ivory. I would amplify this to say that, like Jane Austen, Rosenthal's concerns may sometimes seem small-scale and very British, or even English. This is shown by the subjects of some of his plays. For instance, Another Sunday and Sweet F.A. from 1972, which we saw the opening of a minute ago, concerns the institution of amateur league football matches played on a Sunday morning. In that case, CWS Albion 2nd 11 versus Parker Street Bus Depot. Other topics in Rosenthal's plays include voting day in a village hall, an extra in a television play who can't deliver his lines, a woman waiting for a new desk to be delivered at work, and the trauma suffered by parents when their children leave home for university. But comedy arises precisely from the implication that existential truths reside in such apparently parochial material. And this is true, for example, of The Chain, a play from 1985 about furniture removal men, which manages to combine references to continental philosophy with references to Thatcher's Britain. The film's title refers to the chain into which one enters when buying or selling a house, and it also inevitably shows that moving house often entails upward social mobility. Hence, the title's ironic reference to the great chain of being of the Middle Ages, which was a visual metaphor for the notion of a divinely ordained universal hierarchy, and also to its contemporary form, the British class system. The next extract is from The Chain, and we'll see the foreman of the furniture removal men, played by Warren Mitchell, who is revising for a philosophy night class, and he manages to link this material to the realities of furniture removal.
Right, from where we left off, please, mate.
It's going home time.
Oh, it's the last one, isn't it? Exams in 2 hours.
I can't pronounce him.
Vigo. Gambastista Vigo.
Irishman, is he?
See, what he's saying, what his point is there's birth and growing, and then decaying, then rebirth, then regrowing again.
That's cobbler, isn't it?
What is?
Who gets reborn? Who do we know?
He means civilization, doesn't he? The human race through the centuries. It's like a circle, isn't it?
You'll end up as balmy as them, you know that, don't you?
Come on, heads down, he sums it up how?
He sums it up like, if you leave your doorstep and travel as far as you can, well, all you do is, like, finish up back in your own doorstep again, what you started from in the first place.
Well, even if you travel right round the world?
Of course. Bound to enter, the world's round, isn't it? So what he's getting at, really, is that it takes the whole journey, all your life, to get to know yourself, what you're about.
I know what I'll be about tonight, darling. A few Guinness down the pub, till leg over time, and then
I don't want to know, so.
The funny thing is, I once knew a bloke called Tourville.
What?
Sid Tourville. No relation, I don't think. He had all Rosemary Clooney's records and a drooping eyelid.
Who's Rosemary Clooney?
I don't know if he could skate, though. He never said.
I make no apologies for the very strange trousers and hairstyles people used to have in 1985. Rosenthal was the first in his family to go to university, and his anomalous intellectual and class position as a result is one that affects many of his plays. And I'm now going to give two examples of this. The first is from an episode of Coronation Street, shown on the 16th of October 1961, and the second is from Bar Mitzvah Boy, which was shown in September 1976. I've chosen these two because in both we see the rebellion of a young man against his background, and more specifically, the class and culture of his father. They also differ in several ways. Soap opera such as Coronation Street is still considered a low televisual form, while Bar Mitzvah Boy was a prize-winning play for today. As we'll see, this generic difference has implications for the plot in both cases. First, Coronation Street. This is the episode we have to search for. In this episode, the residents of the street go on a bus trip to see the Blackpool illuminations. And amid various kinds of intrigue during the evening, we learn what Ken Barlow thinks about the outing in a conversation with his wife-to-be, Valerie Tatlock, who later appeared in Dinner Ladies. Okay.
They're happy, Ken. They wouldn't come otherwise, would they?
No, they don't know any better. They live in dumps like Coronation Street, and they think this is paradise.
Well, what's wrong with it?
Everything. It's overcrowded, overcharged. It's not right, Val. People deserve better than this. Some people work hard, very hard, all the year round, and this is what they get at the end of it. If only they could want a bit more.
Well, it wouldn't do if everyone was alike, would it?
Well, it's just what they are in this place, like a lot of sheep.
Look, Ken, you enjoy yourself going to the theatre and reading and all that. Well, other people are different. They enjoy this.
You mean they think they do, because they don't know any better.
You're not enjoying yourself, then?
I am. But then I enjoy being with you.
Well, let's see your smile, then. Hey, where are you going now?
I'm good.
I'm glad you were able to see how beautiful Ken Barlow used to be. In this extract, we can see that Ken is an archetypal example of the scholarship boy, to use the phrase popularised by Richard Hoggart's 1957 book, The Uses of Literacy, Aspects of Class Life. He won't stop. The Hoggart Archive, I should mention, is the Hoggart Archive is also in the University Library, and Sue Owen, who's working on this archive, drew to my attention Ken Barlow's fittedness for a lot of Hoggart's work. The scholarship boy is a young man who, in Hoggart's words, is emotionally uprooted from his class, often under the stimulus of a stronger critical intelligence or imagination than that of those around him. This is literally true of Ken Barlow. In the series' first episode, the ne'er-do-well Dennis Tanner asks Ken, challengingly, why his name hasn't been in the paper recently. Has he not won any more scholarships? Hoggett adds that the test of the scholarship boy's real education lies in his ability, by the age of about 25, to smile at his father with his whole face. Ken Barlow fails this test. In the first ever episode of Coronation Street, we see Ken in conflict with his father at the dinner table. Unfortunately, Rosenthal didn't write this episode, Tony Warren did, but Rosenthal adopted the whole plot of Ken as the scholarship boy wholesale, as you could see from that snippet. In this first episode, Ken disapproves of his father's fondness for HP sauce and the fact that the bread is served already buttered at the table, inspiring his father to ask, "What's that snooty expression for? Don't they do this at college then? I bet they don't eat in their shirt sleeves either." This kind of writing clearly struck a chord with Rosenthal in its representation of class relations through the small and specific details of everyday life, in particular those of food. Ken also finds it common, as he puts it, to hear his mother call his father Dad. Although this is an instance of class disdain, it is also another way for Ken to reject his father by not having him named as such. The brief scene that we've just seen at Blackpool implicitly continues Ken's scorn for the way of life of his father, who is a postman. But, as some of you may know, Ken Barlow is the only character who is still starring in Coronation Street who is in the very first episode. He continues to live on the street in a small terrace house, rather than elsewhere in the suburban semi that his upward mobility might suggest. It's as if the open-ended form of soap opera has conspired with Ken's inertia to prevent his completing a rebellion against his father. If Ken remains in the series until his death, which looks all too likely, will that represent the triumph of Frank Barlow's way of life and the failure of Ken's Oedipal ambitions? The next and last episode is from Bar Mitzvah Boy. Once more, it's at the dinner table that we see a difference of vision between father and son. In this instance, the boy is only 13, in contrast to Ken's 21. However, in this case, the bar mitzvah boy, Elliot Green, is silent but judgmental until the very end of the sequence. Elliot watches and listens rather than arguing, as Ken does, almost as if he is gathering material for his own play. What we're going to see is the Friday night before Elliot's bar mitzvah the next day.
She looked it up in the telephone. Horrible, isn't it?
The soup? I just warmed it up. You cooked it.
My hair. It's ruined. You could all say I'm not sensitive. I look terrible.
It's beautiful.
You look gorgeous.
Emmis?
Emmis.
Victor? Victor!
Hello.
What do you think?
What about?
Your honest opinion. You hate it. I don't mind.
Good. I don't even know what you're talking about.
My hair.
What can I say? It's hair.
But do you like it?
It's done me no harm. Oh.
I've never seen it look so nice.
Emmis?
You said that once.
Emmis.
Good. She's coming to give it a comb out first thing in the morning. I'll ask her to take out the streaks.
That's what's so beautiful, the streaks.
Oh, well, in that case.
Fantastic. Really fantastic. Great.
Mum? Nice?
A banquet. Straight up. Tremendous.
Mum?
It's lovely, darling. You didn't warm the brisket on too high a light, you don't think?
It doesn't taste burnt.
No, it's nice. It's crispy. It's different.
Crispy. Dad?
What?
Leslie wants to know. Nice dinner?
The whole bloody family's gone potshop.
It's like a dinner. I'm eating it.
Stan and Dora Klein.
What about them?
They didn't RSVP. We don't know if they're coming to the dinner dance. Victor!
If they come, they come. If they don't, they don't. Confucius Cohen. Pass us all.
To the seating plan, though. It'll make Ash and Blotter the seating plan. They should be on the second table and it's full.
Well, they're not relations.
He's a doctor. He expects it. They give him a beautiful present, though.
They may not be coming.
Yeah, but by the same token...
Peter, let me eat!
You'd think they'd RSVP, a man in his position.
Perhaps they didn't get the invitation. Perhaps they were in Bournemouth. He's a doctor. Perhaps he can't read decent writing. Perhaps he couldn't afford a stamp. Who can?
Stamped already. It's a stamped address card. There's no expense spared.
Rita, for the first time in 3 months, may I eat without hearing seating plans and menus and caterers and do we tip the rabbi? And should we invite Miriam? And what if it rains? And should I wear a long dress or a short dress? And nothing will spoil it, will it? In the morning, he gets bar mitzvahed. In the evening, we have the dinner dance. And by Sunday, it's all a dream. Thank you. Amen.
We should give her a bouquet. Not too dear.
Who?
Mrs. Sherman.
Is she anyone we know?
The rabbi's wife.
Certainly give her a bouquet. I've never met the woman. Give everybody a bouquet. Plant trees for him in Israel. It's already costing me 3 insurance policies. Roll on Sunday.
You want it over with. The greatest honor of your life.
You know what I mean.
I'm afraid I don't. Harold, do you know what he means?
Well, in a sense. Well, yes and no. What he, in my view, well, doesn't mean...
She knows what I mean. She knows what I mean even when I don't. Hey, Blabbermouth, you're going to practice your speech tonight?
Yeah.
He'll practice his speech like he went for a haircut.
Didn't you like your dinner?
Terrific.
Apart from not eating it.
Wasn't hungry.
And tomorrow morning, before we go to shul, you'll get that haircut.
There won't be time.
Victor, he's not standing in a beautiful synagogue on the greatest day of his life looking like Kojak.
Kojak's bald.
Not Kojak, the other one.
Which other one?
Oh, she picks me up on every little thing.
Leslie, leave your mother alone.
If I don't do the worrying, who will?
No, what's she going on about?
See? Satisfied?
I thought it was a bar mitzvah tomorrow. Thought I was supposed to read the blessings and the portion of the law. Be the guest of one at the dinner dance. The Torah doesn't mention it's a hairdressing contest.
Look, everybody, just eat. All week long, I'm in bloody traffic jams. Just eat!
I'm pleased you could hear people slurping soup. I think that's a very crucial detail. Throughout the dinner scene, Elliot, the young boy, is shown framed by the Sabbath candles on the sideboard behind him, which symbolizes the religious observance that only he is concerned with. His father may utter a prayer ending with Amen, but he does so parodically, and Elliot judges him severely for it. We see many reaction shots through the sequence we've just watched of Elliot's face as his family reveal their materialist and argumentative ways. This prepares us for the twist in the play's plot. Elliot bolts from the synagogue during the bar mitzvah ceremony, thus, apart from anything else, jeopardising the evening's dinner dance for 117 guests. The reaction shots of this almost wordless portrait of Elliot at the dinner table show that we are seeing his view of his family exaggerated into caricature. Although the camera may seem omniscient, what it shows is highly biased. In Bar Mitzvah Boy, the class-based humour focuses on lower middle class rather than working class life. Victor was making reference to the fact that he's a self-employed taxi driver, whereas the son-in-law to be, Harold, is an accountant. In what I think of as a stroke of brilliance, Rosenthal gives a British lower middle class structure a specifically Jewish content, and I would say that no other British Jewish writer has accomplished this. For instance, Eliot's mother does this by proudly citing the Britishly aspirational but déclassé mushroom vol-au-vent that will appear at the bar mitzvah dinner. Eliot's father, Victor, laments his daughter's boyfriend Harold's support for the Conservative Party in terms which give British political formations a Jewish substance. Victor says, "Harold beats me altogether, a Yiddisher fella. When I was a lad, they gave you your Labour Party membership card the minute you were circumcised. Give you with one hand, take away with the other." Whether that says more about Jewish or the history of the Conservative Party is hard to say. The television critic Mark Lawson wrote after Rosenthal's death that Bar Mitzvah Boy ranks among the few British Jewish comedies to match the work of Woody Allen and Neil Simon, by which I think he means that Britishness and Jewishness are not at odds with each other in Bar Mitzvah Boy, but together form a new and hybrid whole. To conclude, I'd like to point out the almost literal centrality of Jack Rosenthal to British televisual history. His career paralleled a formative period of this history between 1961 and 2004. ITV first started broadcasting in 1955, the year that Rosenthal joined Granada. During his decade on the groundbreaking serial Coronation Street, when he also became a freelance writer, Rosenthal branched out to write for the BBC's satire That Was the Week That Was. And many of his plays make satirical reference to the rivalry between state and commercial broadcasting. It was during the 1970s, the decade of Rosenthal's writing storm, as he put it, that there is the closest fit between his dramatic preferences and the priorities of televisual commissioning. Both relied upon the single play as social comedy, rather than the continuous series. Many commentators argue that the single television play of the kind that Rosenthal was happiest writing died out in 1987, the year that Thatcher's Conservatives won a record third term in office. Deregulation was introduced into the television industry in 1988 through a white paper, with the effect that consumers and programme controllers were prioritised over writers and producers. Rosenthal's last play was Ready When You Are, Mr. McGill, an update of his 1976 industry satire of the same name. He wrote it in 2003, but it was not broadcast until after his death, and then on a Sky Channel late at night as a sign of the times. In this play, an aspiring scriptwriter is advised by a network executive to abandon his story about brothers who are bridge-building engineers and to focus instead on stars, police and doctors and shagging. Finally, in conclusion, I'd just like to point to Rosenthal's influence on recent television writing, including The Royal Family and Extras, as well as Alan Bennett's The History Boys and Paul Whelan's recent film 66 about a boy's bar mitzvah set on the day that England won the World Cup, in order to rest my case for a re-evaluation of his work. Thank you.